and welcome back to the TFT podcast. I'm Ryan. That's Matt. Matt, you can't say no to the Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, we could be heroes just for one podcast.
V2 Schneider.
Uh-huh.
Guys, David Bowie, quotation marks, heroes. Not just heroes, quotation marks, heroes.
That's a good point.
Scare quotes. Seriously. So we're just discussing the 1970s. Seriously, guys, we're discussing the 1977 album by David Bowie, Heroes. And so, as always, if you have not listened or either ever or recently to Heroes, go ahead and pause this. Cue it up on your streaming service of choice on the waffles, or as I do on vinyl. I actually have a original vinyl edition of Heroes, and actually got into it. And maybe we'll talk about this after our commercial break. But this is starting a stretch of stuff that I got into when I got a record player and got into vinyl. And so this is an album that I was pleased to own on vinyl and then revisit on streaming. So however you have it, pause, and we will see you back here in a few minutes after these words from our sponsors.
Didn't know whether to go. Are you throwing a haunted house and yet lack that certain something, that ambient creepy soundtrack for your haunted house?
My ghost costume just isn't scary.
Oh, we've all been there. Well, look, you can just play tracks 6 through 9 on this album on repeat, and you will have the Brian Eno-esque ambient creepy weird soundtrack that you have always wanted, including vaguely Japanese sounding music, vaguely creepy sounding music, and a rock and roll song called V2 Schneider.
And as a special bonus, you get to learn all about the secret life of Arabia.
Your guests won't know what hit them when those vocals start at the very end of the record. So for all your creepy background music needs, it's the very record we're listening to.
And we're back. Yeah, this is there's so many entry points here. Mm-hmm. But I think it is, there's a few different points that we can start on. I think that maybe hitting two of the things that we've touched on already. I think one thing that's just really striking with this record is that it really has two halves, right? That there is a first half that corresponds to the sides of the LP, right? The first side one of the LP, Beauty and the Beast, through Blackout, if memory serves correctly, are on side one, and they are more conventional Bowie songs of this era. They're and we could actually talk about what kind of songs they are, but they're kind of art rock, art pop, art funk songs, right? They're funky, naughty rock songs, naughty with a K rather than a N-A-U-G-H-T. Side two is much more of an instrumental side, an instrumental suite. That's also itself actually has an interesting structure where it's bookended by two songs that are largely instrumental but have words. And then inside it, you have three more ambient instrumental pieces that we were talking about. Matt, what did you make of this construction of the album? And we've had some bits of ambient music, of vocalist music in the past, especially when talking about post-rock or even talking about some of the long instrumental passages even within certain songs on the television album that we discussed last week. But what did you think of this specific construction of the two sides of Heroes, and how did you kind of engage with it?
One way to look at instrumental music, I think, is to ask who is the star of this of this instrumental music, right? Like, what is being highlighted or foregrounded? And in the case of television, last week, it's the guitar solos,
yeah.
right? Which is like, that's a kind of a classical model. It's the concerto model with a dynamic, sort of musically charismatic soloist backed by the orchestra or the rhythm section, right?
Right.
And here, this is a completely different model of what the instrumental music is, and you know, it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that sort of Eno was floating around, right? Because who is, by the way, like is the Pharrell of his day, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
because
he is known for his ridiculous hats. No.
I don't know. Just he seemed to crop up a lot in kind of weaved in and out of the scenes that we've been talking about recently,
and only more so, I think, going forward. And we haven't totally set the exact chronology and schedule for this next run of the late 70s up to the 80s. This last run of the next run of this historical stretch, Eno figures. It was the producer or co-producer on almost, I would say, a majority of the records. And I think that's in part his like presence at this time in certain scenes, in this kind of post-punk, early new wave scenes, and in part because I happen to really like the things that he does, as well as his, you know, both the albums that he works on as a producer and his work as a producer and some of his solo work at the time.
Big fan of Music for Airports. Well, no, that was later, right? Like that.
I really like Here Come the Warm Jets, which is sonically pretty similar. Actually, it's the Brian Eno starring kind of counterpart to this era of Bowie, right? So this is, you know, a period where Bowie Heroes is the middle part of what is kind of known as the David Bowie, the Berlin Trilogy, right? It's the second of three albums that were produced with Brian Eno in West Berlin in the late 70s, right? So the first is Lodger, which has a similar kind of structure. Heroes is the second, and No, sorry. The first was Low. It goes Low, Heroes, Lodger. And Here Come the Warm Jets has a similar sound to these records, and is a pretty awesome and weirdly rocking album in its own right, and is a bit before you know, moves then into the more ambient stuff that it's more like the second side. So this is a lot of people associate, you know, with side two of Heroes and that kind of sound, but in fact he himself, some of his own work, has also produced stuff that sounds more like side one, the more harder to define pop but not pop music.
I want to talk about genre. I have questions about genre in this album, and I want to know what you think of them. But just following on, closing the loop on the particular loop that we were in. It's almost as if in these three or four, four instrumental songs, that like nothing is the hero of these songs, right? That like sort of absence or something is the hero of these songs. And I thought this is whimsical, but I thought of you saying naughty with N-A-U-G-H-T-Y, but like of or relating to nothingness being the definition, right? Like, you know, having the characteristics of naught. And I don't know if it's, I mean, if it's something about the time. I mean, I you know, it's not, Bowie isn't sort of a, you don't think of him as like sort of nihilistic in the same way that some of the other kind of more punk acts that we've talked about are.
There's no future for David Bowie.
But There is something in the air, right? And the idea that, like, it's funny because the meta narrative of a lot of what we've been talking about has to do with the aftermath and legacy of the Second World War. And, right. You know, there they are in West Berlin. And yes. Once we sort of start close reading and we talk about heroes, right? He's talking about the wall. Yeah. And he's talking about the Berlin Wall, which is like, if I read my article, right, like, was right outside the studio window that they were recording this record in, and that Heroes is you know, actually about a liaison that Bowie witnessed, and we can talk more about that later. But right, like, you can't engage the Second World War without engaging kind of the possibility of annihilation by nuclear weapons, right? And by being in Germany, and also, by the way, the what is it called? Hanging Moss. Or it's the third of the instrumental tracks, right? There's the rocket. I think of them this way. I think there's the rock and roll one. There's the creepy Vincent Price one. There's the Japanese.
And there's Moss Garden.
Moss Garden, right. Yeah. The Japanese sounding one. And, cause it's like a picked instrument that sounds like that Japanese picked instrument that you see in all the, like, the movies. And then the fourth one, and then the other one, right?
And then secret, never seen.
But the kind of raises the specter of Japan, right? Like, and you're sort of talking about Axis powers in that third instrumental track, and by being in Berlin. I think it also must have been on David Bowie's mind, just because, like, it seems like up until he stopped doing drugs, he was in this kind of constant, up and down cycle of the drugs, with self-loathing and sort of self-sabotage. And this, seems to be a concern of his music, or a, concern of his personal life that gets expressed in his music. And I mean, I actually want to talk about Bowie himself a little bit, because there's so many reasons to just hate this guy out of envy, First record when he was 20, right? David Bowie. And it didn't set the world on fire commercially, but, you had to wait for, I guess, Space Oddity or something for that. But, like, oh my God, right? Like, it's artistically serious, it's ambitious. It wasn't a huge commercial success, but who gives a fuck, right? Like, it was the kind of announcement of a major talent sort of emerging, and he was 20. The time, right? So fuck him for that, number one, right? He's 30, I think, in 1977, 10 years later, when he's making Heroes. So fuck him for that, right? By the time he's done this, by the time in the intervening 10 years, he already had, like, two complete rock careers. The Space Oddity one and the Ziggy Stardust one.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, and that's, I don't even know what to say about that. And maybe even a third, if you count kind of as a separate thing, I'm looking at the discography.
There's kind of the Thin White Duke, right? The kind of blue-eyed soul era, right? So the kind of Diamond Dogs and Young Americans records as well. And then and I guess, like, the transitional record from that into the Berlin period is this record Station to Station, which is a really, really freaking cool record as well. With TVC 1-5, which is probably one of my favorite Bowie songs. Although actually, there was a period if we could return to, I actually want to return to this, where when I was first really getting into Heroes, I was making a big deal about how V2 Schneider is the best Bowie song, hands down. maybe I'll revisit that pretty ridiculous argument at some point. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I both stand behind it and don't, because its only words are V2 Schneider. But it still rocks.
Ryan, I've really been getting into television recently.
I've been watching a lot of TV, too. This is around the same time, so... Yeah, exactly. Never get in the way of a 21-year-old with a record player. He'll teach you a couple things.
Well, that's I don't know. We could devote a whole whole show just to that, because, like, you know, we all do it. We all fall prey, or I shouldn't even say fall prey, right? It's because it's not necessarily that. It's there's something profound about the kind of the cycles of poserdom that we all go through when we like music and when we get into music, right?
Yeah, totally. Well, and I think it's interesting. Like, Bowie's an interesting time to be talking about that, because one of the things, right, you talk about him having several careers, but another way to understand this is a process of reinvention, of genre and of himself within the genre and of his kind of character of who is David Bowie or what character is David Bowie presenting. That's not unlike, you know, what happens really, I mean, in some ways. You know, it's called being a 20-something, right? And,
sure.
And Bowie just happened to do it after having several successful records in the early 60s and was doing that in the 60s, in the 60s and 70s. And so that he was at a time where, in some ways, America was doing that. You know, that America was, it's the Mad Men times, and we've talked about that a little bit indirectly here in other Overthinking of Properties about the kind of re-quadranting of America that's happening during the 60s. And it's, I think there's these analogous processes of self-discovery, and there's these elements of that that are cycles of that that are somewhat more poserish and also more kind of more pretentious in that it actually involves pretending in a way, and then certain elements of that, certain parts of that accumulate and stick and become core. And I think that part of what's really interesting about the Berlin era Bowie is, I mean, I want to kind of return to this idea about the nothingness and different elements of nothingness that are here. That it's not that this is necessarily a minimalist record, but there are elements of these other identities that were worn more like outfits or looks or costumes, and they're stripped away, right? If you look at the iconic cover of Heroes, it's interesting, right? That on the one hand, it's just Bowie, right? It's just Bowie with relatively minimal makeup for Bowie. for me, it's a shit ton of makeup, but for Bowie, it's not a lot of makeup.
Yeah. That's how he woke up like this.
He woke up he's kind of doing the flawless hands, isn't he? David Bowie woke up like this. Goddamn. And I think what's interesting, right, is on the one hand, it's like, natural, it's a natural Bowie, and yet natural Bowie is making this like very stiff and artificial kind of genuflection. How do you read the gesture of his, the positioning of his hands, of his head, the use of shadow, the different dilation of his pupils? Because there's definitely this balance between kind of naturalness and kind of removing away, and yet still of posing, right? He is a – look, I'll say it. On the cover of Heroes, David Bowie is a poser.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he is posing. And I'm going to put in the show notes a link to an image that – shows what I think is one, I think there's actually like, I think he's paying homage to a couple of things. One is a famous photograph, and this, I don't know this, this is from Wikipedia, right? The cover photo, I think is inspired by, work, a painting called, and I'm gonna get this wrong, Rockwirol or something like that, by Erich Heckel. And, it also served as the inspiration of the cover of The Idiot with Iggy Pop,
right?
Playing Bowie here. So this is I'll put this into the show notes so that you can have a look and see this particular pose. But there's also, I mean, there's something about it that gives a sense of like the almost an archaic bow, you know, almost like an Elizabethan sort of bow of greeting.
I kind of mentioned genuflecting.
Yeah.
Actually, in some ways that way is another actually connection even to, to Moss Garden and kind of, you know, tea ceremonies or something that's adjacent to that world that you were discussing, right? And where there are very deliberate motions and hands are put in very specific places, right? Right. Or other kind of ways of formally bowing. So I see that as well.
So this is very interesting, right? And like, it sort of speaks to artificiality and kind of poserness, right? And we've just come out of punk, you know, and so we're entering either new wave or post-punk or, I mean, you know what I mean? We're kind of in, television seems to me to go into, I guess, what gets called post-punk. And this seems to go into what gets called new wave. Or, you know, glam. I was actually surprised by some of the sound of this music because I always associate Bowie with glam and I associate glam with perhaps a more poppy sound. But hold that for a second. Right? Like the idea of artifice and theatricality is something that we've dug into a whole lot before, but I think it becomes really relevant and sort of pointed here in the context of punk, right, which is not just an aesthetic, but is kind of an identity-based movement, and the idea of if you're kicking Richard Hell out of television, right, for performing too much like a Sex Pistol.
Right.
For jumping around and all that stuff. You are trying to exclude certain kinds of performativity or certain modes of performativity, but in doing so, you foreground performativity, right? You sort of create acceptable and unacceptable modes of performativity, and once you raise the specter of theatricality, once you make reference to that, it's performativity all the way down. You really can't escape it. And so punk has this... seems to be always concerned with this test, which purports to be a test of intrinsic identity, but is actually a test of the performance of identity.
Right.
And that, because they all are, right? And because they can't be anything else. And Bowie, I think, you know, with great panache, turns that on his head with his theatricality and with his kind of, you know, different kind of kaleidoscopic modes of performance.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that I mean, it's interesting. Maybe we can just zoom in. I think this comparison and contrast of Bowie in the context of punk is really interesting. And so maybe it's useful to actually turn back to heroes of David Bowie at the Berlin Wall and juxtapose that with Johnny Rotten at the Berlin Wall, right? And so when we did the Sex Pistols 2 weeks ago, we talked a bit about Holiday in the Sun, which is actually very similar, right? It's very rare that you get these kind of comparative case studies in pop songs but you actually here's the case where the the songwriter and the speaker in the song are both visiting the same major place around the same time, right? And that song is, as we talked about, Johnny Rotten is sort of saying, they're watching me, and I want to go over the wall, I want to go under the wall. And this kind of, we talked about it, this kind of sense of imprisonment, and kind of islands, that with respect to the Sex Pistols project. How do you read Heroes, the title track, in relation or contrast to the Sex Pistols time at the Berlin Wall?
Well, it doesn't have the sort of exuberance, right? It's funny. The song is sort of a fantasy, right? The song is like, I think the impetus of the song is by seeing, and this was, he said, seeing just an anonymous couple, canoodling in the shadow of the Berlin Wall and thinking, well, this is an interesting place for for an assignation like this, and kind of narrativizing it, kind of making up a story in the way that you do about, random people that you see on the street. It came out later, I guess, and Bowie, I think, confirmed this according to the Wikipedia, that it was the producer of the record. It was Visconti. It was Mr. Visconti who having an affair with one of the backup singers, right, on the record. And so these were the two particular people that he saw snogging, right, in the shadow of the Berlin Wall. And in a way, right, that's a little more, I don't know, there's something kind of sweet about it, but his response is to write this song that's kind of about futility, right? Mm-hmm. It's not I want to go over the wall. It's not I want to go under the wall. It's sort of we could be heroes just for a day. The heroism is kind of constrained. Our agency is so fundamentally constrained that it doesn't have that the song, relates to the wall, relates to history, relates to the idea of constraint, not with a howl of protest, but with a kind of tragically beautiful resignation.
Yeah, right, and it's interesting to then see. Again, we were talking about kind of nothingness, and actually, right, that there it's actually there in late in the verse, right, where he says, "I wish you could swim like the dolphins, like dolphins can swim," right, and so already, and then he says, "Though nothing." Nothing will keep us together.
Right.
And so it's interesting, right? Here's the words that we have repeated just in this verse. We have I repeated, we have dolphins, and we have nothing. And I think it's a very interesting construction. But I think that especially like at the nothing, the double nothing is at the center of this. And nothing will keep us together. And when you start playing that through, it's interesting, right? There's this kind of paradox built in that of on the one hand, like there is nothing can keep us together. There's nothing that can keep us together.
Right.
But then nothingness keeps us right. That in fact nothingness is the glue that keeps us together.
Yeah.
Right. And both of these are there and are living together. And I think that is I mean, I think that there's, interestingly, then an awareness of the human in the void, the human in the nothingness, because the, you know, that the, oh, this awareness of nothingness and nothing keeping us together is contrasted to the dolphins, right? So the dolphins can swim, right? They can move through liquid.
Yeah.
And so somehow that is about either escape, about fluidity, about movement, you know, about movement through kind of liquid fields. And then that's juxtaposed with this idea that's much more evokes kind of binding or adhesion. And so I think it's a really, really interesting set of lines. I mean, what do you have any kind of take on that or the rest of the song?
Well, liquid versus solid, I think, like sort of unbounded versus bounded. they're dolphins in the ocean. You know what I mean? They're not dolphins the other thing. That's not the ocean. An aquarium.
A tank. Yeah.
Exactly.
A can of tuna.
Yeah. And you
too
can't.
Soon?
Yeah. the other thing that I think is an interesting question in this song is who is the them? You know?
Yeah.
Like, not because certain kinds of statements are made about them throughout the song. There's only one nothing there. Nothing will drive them away. We can beat them just for one day, you know? Though nothing will keep us together, we can beat them forever and ever. The gun shot over our heads. I'm sorry, I'm looking for another one. Who are the they? Is it like the East Germans, you know? Is it communism? Is it
parents? Adults?
Well, right. Like
everyone.
Is it like literally everyone else?
Literally everyone else?
Yeah,
right.
Who's not everyone? Who's not a party to our kind of fantasy? The you and the I of the song, the king and the queen, right? Like everyone who's not the king and the queen, the idea that what we're making here in our heroism is ephemeral, and is kind of doomed.
If you can be heroes for one day, what are you all of the other days?
just for one.
Right. So what, and I'm serious. It's not an entire. It's a little bit of a rhetorical question. But what is the ever? I guess all the other days we are them.
Yeah.
Right. But today we are heroes.
Yeah, because we sort of steal time, right? Like
yeah.
There's something right like. There's something in the repetition, like one reason repetition can go a lot of ways. One reason to repeat things is to insist on the things in the face of disagreement or in the face of evidence to the contrary.
Right.
You know, like we can be heroes. No, we can be heroes. No, I'm right. I'm serious. We actually can.
Or we could be heroes.
Yeah. we can beat them forever and ever. And the idea, there is something kind of capital R romantic in the idea that being heroes just for one day constitutes beating them forever and ever. You know, that there is a kind of permanent, it's the kind of high romantic, idea, artistic idea that's like, you know, you burn brightly and that is your apotheosis and your great achievement, right? Like, being heroes for a day deals some blow to the them, you know, who are our oppressors, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. And I mean it's almost like this existence proof. So it's not even that it implies – I mean, it's an interesting question though. So it's because it's not really a theory of heroism that – one way to think of heroes is that heroes inspire others, right? So one way to think of it is that you know, that you kind of beat them by, like, sparking the revolution. And this doesn't seem to be the case. It's just that it's this existence proof of if you can be heroes, like, if you can do this, then you have done that. And that is that, like you say, that itself shows that another world is possible, but it doesn't necessarily need to create that world. It tears the curtain a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that the you know, that moment is just that moment of this other view poking through a little bit. If that wildly mixed metaphor makes sense.
Conveniently enough for the artist, right? Like, if, because it frees you from the need to bring about lasting and substantial social change,
right?
You know, and that's, I mean, like, in the way that this is what you could call the politics of the Sex Pistols kind of more radical. Well, I think it's actually not that much of a leap to call the politics of the Sex Pistols more radical, because they are, you know, they are actually, I mean, the Sex Pistols actually have more in common with Ronald Reagan, right? Like saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall,
right?
Which is perhaps the first time anyone has ever uttered that phrase in the history of mankind. The Sex Pistols, they're just like Reagan, right?
Also, know. both are anti-abortion.
Oh God, they are like, right.
We didn't talk about that song when we talked about the Sex Pistols record.
Bowie is saying that no, it's a wall for contemplation, you know,
right.
Rather than a wall for sort of knocking down, or a wall for some sort of a wall that is kind of a nexus for some political action, you know.
I mean, so it's to kind of pivot on that. I mean, do you see any kind of, so do you see that this album as a whole, how do you see that with respect to some of these trajectories of problem records and social records that we've been talking about through this quarter? Is it divorced from them? Is it kind of distancing itself from them, or does it engage with them in a way that's just somewhat different vocabulary?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you see this as relating to that, the trend of the hard rains, and harvests of the 60s into the 70s?
In other words, you're asking David Bowie, what's going on?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it's, I don't know. Do you think it's in Sons of the Silent Age, or maybe it's I don't know. Maybe it's in Beauty and the Beast a little bit. You know, I'm not totally sure. I feel like this isn't, I feel like this is not a record that is politically engaged in the same way that a lot of what we've been talking about, is politically engaged. It's a record that's kind of, it seems to be dealing with it, with personal realities, with sort of the inner meanings of things, and with, narrativization, right? Like Bowie's
right.
response to the Berlin Wall is to kind of make up a story about the people standing in its shadow,
right.
You know? And
I think that you mentioned Beauty and the Beast. I think that that may be one place to look, right? Especially like if we look at verse 2 of Beauty and the Beast, all right, it's something in the day, or something in the night, something in the day. Nothing is wrong, but darling, something's in the way. There's slaughter in the air, protest on the wind. Someone else inside me, someone could get skinned. How? My, someone fetch a priest. You can't say no to the Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And so I think that, I mean, it actually sort of speaks exactly to what you were saying, right? That, you know, there is what's going on, right? That there's two what's that are going on, right?
Huh.
There's the external what is going on, and the internal what is going on.
Yeah.
And it's not, he's not just saying like let me do me, But that they're, I kind of see them, these two what's rubbing against each other, right? I kind of, especially through the language of someone else inside me, someone could get skinned. I kind of almost imagine that something that's kind of like a snake shedding its skin, and that it is and this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier of Bowie stripping some of his previous artifices and some of his previous identities of idea of a snake rubbing its skin off on a rock or something else, and so that the things that are going on are. I mean, that part of the way that Bowie's engaging with them is in rubbing off his skin. And again, it's not just that, oh, you know, that this, you know, social conflict, social upheaval, Cold War threat of annihilation. There's a little bit of like, well, this is helping me work through some shit. Thank God for that Cold War, because it's helping me figure myself out. But I think that it's, I mean, I think it's also interesting that it also goes the other way, right? That part of how there's, I think if there's a mode of engagement here, and this kind of gets back to being heroes, it is in kind of doing you, and in kind of getting this someone else inside you out. And that is kind of engaging, is engaging with, what's going on externally. Does that, yeah. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like the you know, remember Venus from Marky Moon, which strikes me in connection with what you're saying about these lyrics. The world looks so thin, and between my bones and my skin, there stood another person.
Exactly.
Who was a little surprised to be, face to face with a world so alive. And it seems, I mean, it seems
drugs are all about drugs, 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 drugs.
It seems to me that there's something, well, yeah, I mean, there's definitely not that reading.
There's not drugs. Like.
No, there's a mountain of cocaine. There's enough cocaine for three Fleetwood Macs. I near as I can tell from the reading I've been doing, but like someone could get skinned, right? Is like the idea of the person between my bones and my skin sort of getting revealed, you know? Yeah. And it's very interesting. Like one of the things that's important, right, about history is the story that we tell to ourselves about history, right? Like history is not just an event; it's a story of an event, and the way the event is kind of narrativized to different ends and in different contexts over the course of time, by different groups of people, around, and that narrativization is a kind of personal process. It happens. Inside, right? Like if the Ramones were on a rocket, Bowie is sort of a deep sea diver. You know, he's down with the dolphins, kind of like deep in the waters of the self. And whereas the Ramones seem to be, and to a certain extent, Sex Pistols also seem to be kind of non-introspective about. Well, it's a straw man in the case of the Sex Pistols, but not the Ramones. The Ramones were non-introspective about, you know, their own psychologies or right. something like that, right? Like,
I don't want to go down to the basement. I just don't want to. I don't want to.
Right. And Bowie.
Don't want to. I do want to be sedated. Don't want to go down to the basement. Want to be your boyfriend. Don't want to go down to the basement.
Right. Nope. Just don't want to do it. Bowie is like, well, let's meditate on the different meanings of the basement, right? Like there's something in the night, you know, there's something in the day. Something's in the way. I mean, and there's kind of there's like really a mood of threat, right? But rather than conflating the threat with actual political oppression, like Marvin Gaye does in What's Going On, which kind of makes sense, given that song's genesis in witnessing protests being kind of violently attacked by by the authorities. Here, the menace comes from within, right? Like. It's the political unrest or the sense of unease, right? Like there's a sense of unease, and the way it's narrativized is as being something that is personal, being something that's generated inside the psyches of the individuals who perceive it, and the sort of the Beauty and the Beast are kind of aspects of the same. Person, right? Like you could be heroes forever and ever. You also can be like a terrible monster, with slaughter in the air.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, it's striking that actually one of the songs, the Vincent Price song that we talked about earlier, is called Sense of Doubt.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think it's very much there, right? That this that's really bound up in exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And that, like, Genius has, why am I calling it Genius? Fucking Rap Genius.
You almost just bought their branding, man.
we are the geniuses. We could be geniuses just for a day. single cover on it, the RCA single of Beauty and the Beast, which I think was the second single released from this album after the title track, and it has actually three weights of Helvetica on it, both the book
peak,
weight.
We're in peak Helvetica this time.
Oh God, that is a very good. I mean, I recommend heartily to anyone the documentary film about Helvetica. It's a pretty good documentary. Has the book weight, the bold weight, and the black weight. The cover photograph is a sort of is a very contrasty. So it's almost. Black and white without a lot of grays in between. Picture of David Bowie on his side, right? Kind of leaning to the side. It's a picture of his, it's like a bust, but he's kind of like has his head on a table or something. His face occupying only the lower half of the frame of the square record, and his dilated pupil, the one that his friend punched when they got in a fight when they were kids, and he has this constantly dilated pupil, is painted red, right? Though it's
Terminator. It's Terminator Bowie.
Exactly. And so this is kind of like, and by the way, the only other red thing is his name on the record. And so like David Bowie, is the kind of redness inside the eye of David Bowie. And the idea that there is this kind of redness in a world of black and white,
world. Go on.
The midnight hour is close at hand. The creatures crawled in search of blood. I'm going to do the whole speech if we're not careful. There is this kind of red pulsating like Terminator within, that is the source of the sense of threat and the sense of kind of social unease that we're talking about.
Right. Well, that's actually interesting, right? That we could, and again, it's interesting how much in talking about this now that actually a lot of the concerns on Heroes are really rhyming with and kind of in dialogue, at least implicitly, with what we identified in Marquee Moon, actually, right? And I think a little bit about – I think this is also in Venus, right? We're like, hey, we could dress up like cops, but then for some reason we didn't, right? And something said don't. And I think that this idea of the threat from within and these kind of destructive tendencies within one – are really interesting, right? And so, I mean, that's also, to kind of tie up some of the threads, like, we could be heroes or we could annihilate everything. These are the two options.
Right.
We could be heroes or everything stops to exist.
That is a good. That is a good point. That like could there, you kind of hinge on a double sense of could. There, right? Like, we have the potential to be heroes, right? Or the potential for to be East Germany, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and I think that, and to kind of circle back then to how that relates to this sense
of... Or rather, like, sorry, Ryan. I don't mean to stomp you. I just clicked for me. It could be a counterfactual. We could be heroes, but we aren't.
Right.
Right. We have the potential to be heroes, but we are the beast, you know? That's interesting. Sorry.
Sorry, exactly. No, and this still dovetails with what I was going to say. Of just a few other pieces that are kind of supporting this reading, is to get back to kind of senses of annihilation, the specter of annihilation, in the aftermath of World War II. I think one other thing, to point out is that V2 Schneider, the V2 in V2 Schneider is named after the V2 rocket, right? And so this rocket
and
is not
Schneider is named
rocket.
After a member of Kraftwerk.
Yeah, good. I see that we're both reading Wikipedia. But I mean, right. This is a German missile, right? And I think that was, you know, that, right. How I read that, is that where they used, I mean, it's like one way to read that is like, guys, Germany, not a threat anymore. They used to send rockets. Now they send Kraut rockets. Like, which are just songs that last, they're just like 10-minute locked in like electro jams. It's totally cool. And you have these I think V2 Schneider the song is a cool encapsulation of that. Like, I love the horns on V2 Schneider. Like, I always have wanted to use that for entrance music for something. Like, I want to. The song makes me want to have a reason to enter a room in the way that it demands, right? Because it's just it's soulful. It's not exactly jazzy, but like it's somewhat jaunty and springy. There's this kind of sense. It's interestingly, right? Like it has a sense of ease, and so it is. You know, it's like the way that David Bowie stopped worrying and learned to love the bomb is through sweet horns, right, and synthesizers, and that is like the flip side of the sense of doubt, and they're both there, right, and so it's about this kind of you know, finding out which one is within, and they're both there, right? The Terminator and the hero are within, and there is some amount of mystery there, right? And that kind of, just to kind of ring the changes on many of the of what else is here, even though we've talked a bit about the Secret Life of Arabia being kind of goofy, when you actually engage with it, you know, like looking at the lyrics, right? I was running at the speed of life through morning's thoughts and fantasies. Then I saw your eyes at the crossfades, secrets never seen, right? And so this kind of escapability of the interiority of others, and the kind of uncertainty and doubt that is there, on the one hand, has a sense of, there's a sense of wonder there, right? A sense of mystery, and also a sense of threat. And they're living together on this record, in really interesting ways, right? So this is a very interesting, so it is very much a product of its time, and in dialogue with the 70s, in this portion of the 70s, but in this very particular way.
And all the way back to Space Oddity, which is kind of the earliest thing I know well, right? There is that sense of wonder coupled with a sense of threat, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm floating in the most peculiar of ways.
Yeah, sure. Right? Or even like, planet Earth is blue and there's nothing I can do.
Right.
You know? Can I pivot a little bit?
Sure.
Because I want to talk about the dichotomy that you're talking about in terms of the music. And in terms of the musical influence. I was surprised, and this is gonna sound bad because I'm about to say black. But I was surprised by how black parts of this record sounded. By which I mean how much blues and, you know, kind of American rock and roll with its
blues funk soul.
Yeah, exactly. With its kind of roots deeply in African American music of like the Mississippi Delta and whatnot. I mean, it's funny. Is there a more culturally potent phenomenon than the African diaspora? You know, I don't know, right? But like, it's not just the Northern Hemisphere, right? Like everything you associate with like South America, with like salsa music and stuff like that.
This is Master Thompson, right? This is New York Mambo, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. Yeah, it's African. It's African rhythms. I mean, it's hard to think of as influential of folk music. I suppose Celtic music. You know, being spread throughout Europe, the British Isles. I mean, the British Isles are weird because being islands, they didn't have quite the same history. And then coming to America in the form of like traditional American music with you know, Irish or Scottish immigrants to America. But then, you know, they meet the black slaves or the descendants of the black slaves, and it all kind of melts down together. But anyway, the first sound on this record is like the most abbreviated of like electronically manipulated percussion sounds or synthesizer sounds, immediately followed by a hi-hat and like a honky-tonk piano playing a little blues lick. A blues lick that actually kind of reminds me of the opening of Three Women on Lazaretto. It's a, you know, like a dominant seven kind of blues scale melodic thing. And it doesn't quite go in the same direction, but it put me in mind of that anyway. And so it seems, I mean, it seems like I want to kind of narrativize the blues elements and the synth elements as being as kind of recapitulating this dichotomy that we're talking about between sort of wonder and threat, or between sort of inner world and outer world, you know what I mean? Or sort of between emotion and technology.
And also it's kind of America and Europe.
Yeah,
right?
Sure. Absolutely.
Kind of, it's a re-cremastering of the West, right? That there's this articulation of, it's the remastering of the free world, right?
with London, right. Interestingly, right? Yeah. Like as the pole between the two fields, between the two halves of the cremaster field.
Right, exactly. I think I think we're done. we just turned that last click, and the Rubik's cube of Bowie's Heroes just came up. We're done. We won Bowie.
We are heroes.
We are heroes forever and ever. there's a lot more that we can talk about on this record, but I think this is a good place to leave it. This is a record that I've loved over the last decade, and I often fondly spin. So I'd love to hear what our listeners have to say about it. And so, guys, take to the Twitter in 140 character increments, and you can be Twitter heroes just for one day, or you can be comment heroes. Over at www.overthinkingit.com. So join in that conversation. Stay tuned to both those places to see what we are up to next week. We're still in the 70s for a little while longer because this is a just fertile time.
I think we had planned to move on quickly, and after last week, we both were like, "No, there's a lot more to be done here before we're ready to move into the 80s." You know?
Yeah, and it's really really is, in some ways, we're getting to a time where, and we'll, I think we'll talk about this as we go through this, I mean, that it's really interesting of, you know, some of these records, there are deeper kind of personal connections for one or both of us, and others are things that, like, we have a passing cultural familiarity with but are less engaged with. And this stretch, for whatever reason, this stretch of the late 70s up to 80 was a really fertile period for me about in this period of about a decade ago, 9 or 10 years ago, as kind of immediate post-college. It dialogues interestingly in our contemporary discussion, and I think will give us some V2 rocket fuel pushing forward into the next contemporary quarter, closing out 2014, because, you know, a lot of the sequence is that late in college I got really into the kind of early 2000s indie rock, and then I got bored of that temporarily and got into this music of the late 70s. I got a record player and got into the late 70s in my ridiculous quarter life crisis. Mm-hmm. But then they start to inform one another in really interesting ways. And there's just, I mean, some awesome records coming up on the agenda. So stay tuned for those. But as always, and as it will ever be, it has been real, it is real, and it will be real.
It could be real.
Just for a day.